How's your car looking? Showing its age? Faded paint? Dents? Dings? Don't worry. Maaco is here to help. They're the experts in affordable paint jobs and light collision repairs, helping you keep your car looking its best without breaking the bank. With Maaco's national reach and community focus, you're not just getting top-notch service. You're actually getting a partner you can trust. Visit your local Maaco today and see how they can refresh your ride. Go in, get the free estimate, and the expert technicians will handle the rest. Uh-oh, better get Maaco.
At Designer Shoe Warehouse, we believe that shoes are an important part of, well,
everything. From first steps to first dates, from all-nighters to all-time personal bests.
From building pillow forts to building a life.
For all the big and small moments that make up your whole world, DSW is there. And we've got just the shoes. Find a shoe for every you from brands you love at bragworthy prices at your DSW store or DSW.com.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage of the case against Brian Koberger. We are going to be taking a look here now that the hearing has concluded, now that the plea has been accepted and the plea of guilty is now what Brian Koberger has admitted to. There's a lot of questions about the future. What is going to happen here? And there's some interesting speculation already on the rise. One of the people who has been silent on in this case, but we've been very curious to get answers from, would have been Catherine Ramsland, who was his professor at DeSales University. She's now speaking for the first time with News Nation's Brian Enten, and we're going to take a look at that interview, kind of break it down and discuss a bit. You remember Howard Bloom, not that long ago, had put out that article where he was hypothesizing that, you know, maybe was he doing these things to impress her or to be better than her, because he looked at her kind of like an idol, I guess, so to speak. I mean, she's one of the best at her craft. So, you know, someone who's in it for the right reasons would look at her and go, yeah, you are the best at this. It's... yeah, it was a spooky moment today. I want to take a moment here and we'll take a look at what it looked like in the courtroom earlier. This is, which camera am I going to over here? This is coverage from earlier in the day when we were live. And this is the moment we're going to take a look at where Koberger very, very coldly answers those questions.
Count one, burglary. The state would have to have proven that on or about November 13, 2022 in Latah County, Idaho, you unlawfully entered a residence located at 1122 King Road in Moscow, Idaho, with the intent to commit the felony crime of murder. As to count two, the state would have had to have proven that on or about that same date in Latah County, Idaho, you did willfully, unlawfully, deliberately, with premeditation and malice aforethought, kill and murder Madison Mogan, a human being, by stabbing Madison Mogan, from which she died. As to count three, the state would have had to have proven that on that same date in Latah County, at that same address, you did willfully, unlawfully, deliberately, with premeditation and malice aforethought, kill and murder Kaylee Gonzalez, a human being, by stabbing her, from which she died. As to count four, the state would have had to have proven that on or about that same date in Latah County, Idaho, you did willfully, unlawfully, deliberately, with premeditation and malice aforethought, kill and murder Zanna Kernodle, a human being, by stabbing her, from which she died. And then as to count five, also murder in the first degree, that on or about November 13th, 2022, in Latah County, Idaho, you did willfully, unlawfully, deliberately, with premeditation and malice aforethought, kill and murder Ethan Chapin, a human being, by stabbing him, from which he died. Do you understand those things the state would have had to have proven?
Yes.
And do you understand that by pleading guilty, the state no longer has to prove those things because you're admitting those things are true.
Yes.
I want to also make, for the record, the defendant has provided with the guilty plea advisory form a document entitled Written Factual Basis that purports to have the defendant's signature dated 1 July 2025. Did you sign that document?
Yes.
And did you agree with the written factual basis that is included there?
Yes.
And then let me ask you, did you, on November 13th, 2022,
there it is,
enter the residence at 1122 King Road in Moscow, Idaho, with the intent to commit the felony crime of murder?
Yes.
Did you, on November 13th, 2022, in Latah County, state of Idaho, kill and murder Madison Mogan, a human being?
Yes.
And did you do that willfully, unlawfully, deliberately, and with premeditation and malice aforethought?
Yes.
Did you, on or about that same date in Moscow, Idaho, kill and murder Kaylee Gonsalves, a human being?
Yes.
And did you do that willfully, unlawfully, deliberately, and with premeditation and malice aforethought?
Yes.
And did you, on that same date in Moscow, Idaho, kill and murder Zanna Kernodle, pardon me, a human being?
Yes.
And did you do that willfully, unlawfully, deliberately, with premeditation and malice aforethought?
Yes.
And then on or about November 13th, 2022, again in Latah County, Idaho, did you kill and murder Ethan Chapin, a human being?
Yes.
Did you do that willfully, unlawfully, deliberately, with premeditation and malice aforethought?
Yes.
I would ask the state at this time to provide its recitation of its factual basis had this case gone to trial.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So
basically what we got is a condensed version of what the opening statements would have been. From prosecutor Bill Thompson. The image behind me right now, that's him in court today. That is probably one of the closest up ones that we've seen. That one is not AI. That is him. That is him today in court. Those dead eyes.
Yeah, he does look like a shark. He just does. He just looks empty, like a shell.
Yeah.
He's no longer going to be wearing street clothes the next time we see him. Was it July 23rd we're doing the sentencing?
It is July 23rd and possibly the 24th if they need more time.
Yeah, he'll be in a jumpsuit. He'll be wearing prison garb. Yeah. That's the last time we'll see him in a suit, I'm assuming. Maybe.
It is. That is the last time we're going to be seeing him in a suit. Another thing I found interesting was the scolding of Steve Gonsalves at the very beginning without saying his name.
Yeah.
I found that to be a little like, shut the F up, Judge. Like, I'm sorry this guy lost because your staff and your office fumbled this so badly and didn't give them a chance to like really say their piece, that they're angry. And he goes on TV and says, please let them know. And your response is, have not and will not listen. Pretty tone deaf.
Well, and that's just it. I understand that the law.
I get it. Pretty tone deaf.
I get it too. They have to follow the letter of the law. But here's the thing. These are parents of dead children. At the end of the day, there are four kids who are no longer alive.
Yeah.
Let the man have his emotions. I get it.
And
but
look,
come on.
There was nothing wrong with what he was doing. I mean,
it's not illegal.
Because he felt he was not being heard. So he was going to be heard. And because you didn't want to hear him, tough shit. And there's nothing that, and the thing is, he wasn't trying to sway your opinion with a bunch of people saying this, that he was trying to be heard. He was trying to have you see just how damaging this could be from his perspective. Yeah. And you need to. And I know the judge said I did. Great, but for the love of God, have not and will not listen, and I'm turning him to the authorities. Okay, great. I thought that was shitty. I thought that was that was shitty. I feel horrible for all the families, everybody kind of having different opinions on it. An interesting other piece of what has gone down in the last 24 hours, Dr. Catherine Ramsland speaking for the first time on the case. She was not able to previously because she was on that witness list and was not going to be able to say anything. Now speaking for the first time with News Nation's Brian Enten just the other night. And we're going to watch some of that interview and kind of break down what was discussed and all of that. I want to, before we do that, I want you to take a quick look at this video, because I was just thinking of this before we got in here to record. Wrong camera. Which one do I need to go to here? This one. Okay. Koberger is in the upper right video. And there to me, I'm not going to say anything. Watch it. We'll talk on the other side. I'm not going to turn the sound on.
Yes.
All right. And Mr. Koberg, just to make it easier, you don't need to stand when you speak to me. I appreciate the... I don't want you to plead guilty to a crime you didn't commit. If you attempt to plead guilty today, but for some reason I don't accept your plea, then it is possible that your statements today could be used against
my
you
point
later
is,
at trial.
He, there's like that? An almost... look, yes. There.
Thank you. And now, while you're standing, actually, why don't you take the oath from the clerk?
He wasn't even supposed to stand. So he takes the oath. And if you watch...
Yeah, he stood up when the judge was speaking to him.
Mr.
Like,
Koberg, just to make it easier, you don't need to stand when you speak to me. I appreciate the sign of respect, but for convenience.
I don't think there was a sign of respect, Judge. I think that was a serial murderer that is now basking in the moment, honestly. He was like a turtle out there on a log in a river, basking in the sunlight.
Interesting that you say that, because my perspective was the judge is taking that as a sign of respect, but he didn't have respect for the four people that he killed.
Yeah. That ain't respect, Judge. I know. I mean, I get like how one could look at it that way, but I don't think it was. Because if you watch him right before he stands up, before he even does, he's getting fidgety. Like he cannot wait to get out of that chair and stand up in that courtroom.
He's just popcorning like a guinea pig, right?
Yeah. Really? I mean, literally. Brian Enten was sitting behind his parents in court today. I didn't know earlier if his parents were there or not, but they were. And he said that it was, they weren't crying. They were not crying. You could tell that they were, you know, emotional, but they were not crying.
Probably numb at this point.
As their son sat there and acknowledged that he just murdered four people. Yeah.
They've had a loss too.
Oh, I'm not criticizing them.
I know.
I'm saying I think they've probably been to hell and back with this already. And they've maybe made their peace as best that they can with something like this. I don't know, but I feel horrible for them as well. Let's go and take a look at this conversation that Brian Enten of News Nation had with Catherine Ramsland just the other night. when he was in for Ashley Banfield. Let's... there we go. Let's take a look.
Though, and we're joined exclusively by her, renowned forensic psychologist, Dr. Catherine Ramslin. As you may know, she was Brian Kohberger's professor and advisor at DeSales University in Pennsylvania. She has not spoken publicly about Brian Kohberger until now. She's been on this show talking about other cases, but she's been very, very careful not to talk about Kohberger because of the trial, because she was going to be a witness at the trial, and she now feels comfortable to open up to us. And we've got so many questions, Dr. Ramslin, that I've got so many questions I've wanted to ask you for so long. I want to start with, how did you first meet Brian Kohberger? What classes of yours was he in?
Okay, I want to be just clear that I'm still within the FERPA limitations that protect students and student information. So I will talk within that. I met him in the fall of 2018 when he came to DeSales University. He had an associate's degree, and he was going to get into our four-year program as a psychology major. He selected the forensic track, which made him an advisee for me because I managed the forensic track. And he was also in my class that semester.
And Dr. Ramslin talks about FERPA. I should have mentioned that. There is a law, there is a federal law, I believe, that she is not allowed to talk about certain aspects of a student, their grades, certain parts of their academic life. It's almost like a HIPAA. So she's going to tell us what she can, but unless Brian Kohberger signs off, she's legally not allowed to talk about certain elements of his academic career. So just keep that in mind if there's some things that Dr. Ramslin can't answer. What was your perception of him?
He seemed like eager to be in the classroom. He was polite, he was respectful, intense, and curious. And there was no reason for me to think that he was anything other than someone who was really interested in this potential career.
Was there anything looking back now that was strange about him or that you noticed?
When I look back, there really isn't anything that stood out to me. I think when you're a teacher, your instinct is to accept students at face value. You don't, start with suspicions or, and there really weren't any red flags. He was always really quite respectful and grateful. He would thank me for things. He was attentive. He would do the work. I didn't have any concerns.
Let's stop there for a second. Are you surprised by any of that, or what's your reaction?
No.
I can't say I'm either. He seems to be, what he's into. And I imagine he would kind of be almost like a perfect type student if you happen to be the one teaching the subject that he's into. Look at those eyes. I mean, it's like a hyper focus, hyper to a, imagine if it was used for something productive,
All right.
But I think that's what he thought he wanted. I think he thought this was going to be super productive because I think he thought he'd get away with it. Then he could teach about it or be taught about. And he'll be the one that, is infamous, but he's the only one who knows it. Well, not how that worked out. Let's watch a little bit more of this with Brian and Catherine Ramsland.
I think it was four classes that you taught him in. What were those classes?
There were three undergraduate courses in the forensic track that I taught, and he was in all of them. Well, one was Introduction to Forensic Psychology. Another was my death investigation class, which was called Psychological Sleuthing. And the third one was called Dangerous Minds, the Psychology of Antisocial Behavior. And then I got into the graduate program in criminal justice for a master's degree. And he took a course with me called Behavioral Criminology.
I want to take those classes.
Is there
they sound
anything,
fun.
Dr. Ramslin, when you look back and you think about the curriculum of those classes, and not getting into his specific experience, but when you think about what you taught in those classes that you think, oh my gosh, he may have used that in what he's now accused of doing here in Idaho?
Well, the antisocial behavior course involves serial killers and mass murderers. And we do a lot of case analysis. I use two books that I wrote. One was written with the BTK killer, whom you just mentioned, and his decision process and the crimes and how he thought about them and felt about them and what was it like for him, you know, to be caught. So that's a very intense book. And also I have one called The Mind of a Murderer, which was about various behavioral experts over the past century who interviewed killers, mass murderers and serial killers to get as close as possible, spending a lot of time with them to get as close as possible to their process of becoming a criminal. And so he would have been exposed to that. I think some of the, now looking back, I would look at maybe some of the things that interested him as being, you know, something that gives me pause. But we always have to think about, we all know, everyone in this field, forensic psychology and criminology, know that we could have students who might become offenders. But we also know that the majority, the vast majority of our students will not, and will instead go into a field like law enforcement, FBI, Secret Service, that make the world better, that protect us. That, so we know that there's always a risk that we're attracting somebody who wants to do something terrible. Hoping we won't ever have that, but, you know, in my case, I did.
No, I mean, she's had plenty of time to think about all this. I mean, it's got to be kind of astounding, though, too, when that happens. I wonder if this is the first time she's had a student that has, I mean, it's probably the worst, but if anybody else has gone off the rails, you know, to some extent.
Yeah.
And used that, but.
You know, and that's a question I'd like to ask her. Like, when you're teaching a class and you get to know your students, have you gotten that vibe? I mean, some people are very, they pick up on vibrations, and I don't mean any woo-woo stuff, but I just mean, like, I'm getting a vibe from you that something is just off. And I wonder how many people end up in those classes, because I remember when I was pre-vet in college, you know, you get the ones marching in there and I'm going to be a vet. My dad's a vet. My, you know, grandfather was a vet, and they don't know what they're doing, but they're just giving off this aura of I'm the shit. And I wonder how many of those people she gets in those classes and she goes, you're not going to make it in this field.
I bet a lot. I mean, although by the time you get to her at a graduate level, you're probably pretty good in it. She's not getting like the newbies. This isn't like a freshman level, you know, criminology class. You've spent your time and shown your dedication to this, I think, by the time you get Catherine as your professor.
Well, and I agree with that. Do you think, Brian, if he had held back that impulse to kill somebody, to kill four people, do you think he could have been good at this?
Possibly. I don't have anything to say, you know, his obsessive behavior would certainly, lean itself into that. How good would have he been? I don't know. I mean, the fact that he only did leave the knife sheath, he wasn't horrible. He wasn't great, but he wasn't horrible.
Yeah.
So, and that's just for a student. So I don't know. I mean, I think he, you know, his personality would have always prevented a lot for him, because it just doesn't mix with others. I think probably at some point something would have happened. He would have done something somewhere. Cause if he has this urge for whatever reason he had it, that was going to erupt somewhere, some way, somehow. And this is how it did.
Wow.
I don't know that there'd be I don't know if there's an alternate path for Brian Koberger, or there ever was. I think if your brain is that wired that way, then something, it's going to go. At some point, it's going to go. Unless you go first.
I wonder what his classmates feel about him.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to hear more of that.
Did they pick up on, like, what I'm talking about with the vibe? Because, yeah, you know, we do pick these vibes up from people.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of people who picked up the vibes. There was, the doc that came out, or the Dateline that came out, talks about some of the people that, and some of the people who interacted with him, how kind of odd and off he was. And some people also saying, well, you know, he was like, it's interesting. That's one where I think has some good insights. Here's a little bit more with Brian and Catherine.
Can you say, Dr. Ramslin, what it was looking back now that sort of raises your eyebrows specifically in terms of things in the class?
I think just the idea of wanting to study offenders and what their thought process was, how they felt about their crimes, wanting to study that, and then finding out that this is a person who then is now saying he's guilty of doing these things. I have to look at the framework of what I taught and wonder, did I inspire him in some way? Did I, you know, but I can't second guess that, because I may have inspired somebody else to become an FBI agent.
Yeah.
And that's, unfortunately, in this field, you know, that's what we live with.
I mean, you've been studying serial killers most of your life, but when you talk about the fact that you may have, what you taught may have inspired this, that's got to be hard for you to process, I would imagine.
It's terrible, very hard. And it's not just what happened to the victims. I really thought Brian Koberger was a promising student who really could have made a mark in this career, and, you know, in a very positive way. I thought that. So disappointed, angry, and, you know, very and shocked that, you know, this is who he turned out to be, and horrified for the victims and their families, just horrified. I mean, I worked with Dennis Rader closely for 5 years. I met the victims' families. I saw the devastation that some these kinds of acts can have. And I have to always keep that in mind when I'm teaching these subjects.
What did you think when you first heard that Brian Koberger, your former student, was arrested for this?
I was completely floored. I didn't believe it. And his demeanor that we saw on, you know, on media was that he was confident that he was going to be able to prove his innocence. So I wanted to wait and see. I wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt. But as months go by and he kept saying that he had an alibi, and I wondered, well, why are you sitting in jail? Give us your alibi, get out. And that wasn't happening. And then it was really when he said his alibi, and it was clearly not an alibi, and he would have known that, certainly from all the classes that he had through undergraduate and graduate work, he would have understood that wasn't really an alibi. I think that was when I was really, you know, floored that this is my student who has done these things.
That's a weird part of the whole thing. He knew, like, why keep saying stupid shit?
You know? Right?
Like, why not come up with some sort of alibi? I mean, I don't know. I mean, he knew that that would be insane to say, so he said it.
Yeah.
Or is his mind just so wrapped up in thinking that he didn't even recognize that that would be an insane alibi, because he just thinks he's God. I don't know. Or was it all to mess with the people? What is this like a reverse study in his mind? He's studying us. He's studying the people. He's studying the people that he terrorized. Is all this part of that for him?
You know, it maybe that makes me question if he would have been good in this class, because the alibi is everything.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Did he not think this through? He just thought about the process and not the after part?
No, I mean, I don't know. I just think there's a very twisted way of thinking going on here. But I do wonder if this is part of his thing of, I don't know. Maybe we're way overthinking it too. Maybe it's just a rage and an urge and a hate and I don't know.
You mentioned, I mean, you studied BTK, the serial killer. You met with him many times in prison. This is what you do in a hope to prevent these things from further happening and understand the mind of a serial killer. Would you want to study Brian Koberger? Have you put any thought into that? Is that something that you think could be possible?
I've been thinking about that for 2.5 years. I would. I mean, this is my work. If he wanted to do that, I would. And within the framework of this is what we do to try to look at developmental trajectories, the triggers, so that we can see the red flags faster. We can prevent people like this from wreaking the havoc that they do. So if he wanted to do that, I know that he's got the intellectual capacity to do it, to be self-reflective, to help think through how his life came to this. And so I would definitely do it if he were willing. And it would be hard. But I think because I have so much material from him, I have questions for him that I think nobody else but me could ask.
It feels like the beginning of a horror movie.
And just my last question, Dr. Ramslin, I mean,
where it's like it's like Halloween is what it reminds me of, where it's the killer, the doctor's there talking. If I could study, I would study him. And then, you know, then it cuts to the scene where the study begins, and somehow in that study he breaks out. You know, this is feels just, ooh, it's creepy. It's very creepy. That's a chunk of the interview with Brian Anton and Catherine Ramsland on News Nation from just the other day. The full interview you can find over with News Nation. Yeah.
Spooky. Man. It's not how I thought it would go, but they must have had meetings that, you know what, we aren't going to be able to defend you and you could end up dying.
And at the end of the day, I'm just surprised. I mean, I'm surprised he didn't take the risk, because he's already on the ride and he's been going on the ride over and over and over for the last 3 years without saying, hey, let's turn the roller coaster off. I'm done. Why now?
Yeah.
I mean, I get it. Like, you're facing death, but you knew you were facing until, I guess, you run. At the end of the day, death was what was going to scare him. Death is what scared him. Because I didn't know if he
Which
was afraid
crazy.
Of that. I didn't know he was afraid of that or not. I just kind of thought maybe he's not, and he's just going to go for the whole experience. But he closed Wally World down early. I don't know what that says.
You know, do you think any entity is going to have access to him? Will he be able to talk?
Oh, yeah.
Who do you think is going to get the first interview?
I think it'll be years before he gives an interview.
Wait a minute. We were just talking that this guy was just popcorning, you know, waiting to stand up and be in front of the camera and let everybody see him. I bet he's going to take the bait. They're going to be begging and pounding on the door, and he's going to go, yeah, let me get out there.
Well, I mean, there may be restrictions on that for, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. There may be some, there might be restrictions on that. I can say that. I mean, people could write to
sure.
him. I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, Lori Vallow, they're doing interviews with, so who the hell knows? Anything is possible. I don't know the answer to it, so I'm not going to speculate either way. I don't know that he wants, I don't know. I think it's going to be in a place and time of his choosing, though. I don't know. He was popcorning there, but I think that's because he was in that courtroom and he wanted that moment right there. I don't know that he's, you know, popcorning for a sit down with Diane Sawyer.
Guess we'll find out, won't we?
I think he'd be all about working with Catherine Ramsland. Yeah.
She's not going to interview him, do you think?
No, not as an interview, but as far as telling his story to someone. And she'll end up writing the book, and then she'll explain exactly... that may be how the story comes out.
Mm.
Just like BTK's story, a lot of that came out through Catherine. So I could see a very similar thing here.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's the world today.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Brian Koberger.
As the trial of Brian Koberger barrels towards an August start, the courtroom saw some major movement last week. Key witness subpoenas, strategic motions denied, and the defense's roadmap narrowing by the day. Among the biggest developments, several individuals from Koberger's past in Pennsylvania have now been identified as potential trial witnesses, raising new questions about what role his early life will play in the defense's case. At the same time, the judge shut down two major defense moves, blocking the attempt to introduce a third-party culprit theory and denying the request to delay the trial once again. To help us break down what these witnesses could bring to the table, why the court rejected these latest motions, and what all of this tells us about where the trial is headed, Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent with her experience investigating this sort of stuff and people like this, courtrooms, all of it. Jennifer, she helps us cut through the noise and get to the real implications behind these headlines. So let's jump into this, Jennifer. Let's break down the Pennsylvania witness. Who are these Pennsylvania witnesses, and why is the defense calling them to the aid of Brian Koberger? And from the understanding, a lot of them don't want to have anything to do with it. What's your thoughts thus far?
Well, the defense, as you mentioned in your intro, is really narrowing. They were hoping to get the third-party culprit defense on the table, naming multiple other individuals as being responsible for these tragic murders. But when Judge slammed that door shut, they had to take a different route. And that route is going to certainly be calling other witnesses from his early years. And the purpose of that really is to paint a picture of this individual who was troubled. And I think really trying to lay out issues that he had in his life and in his world to really try to garner sympathy. I think that's the main purpose of most of these witnesses.
Are they there for more of the sentencing area of this than the actual trial itself in terms of trying to save his life? Because I can't imagine anyone saying, well, he was a troubled kid, and that, you know, somehow the jury is going to be like, well, that justifies killing four college kids. He had trouble. Sure. Obviously, they're trying to paint him as a human being. Is that more, you think, the goal here?
Yeah, absolutely. They want to paint early on what kind of person he was, in their own light. And as you said, some of these witnesses are certainly not going to be happy about testifying, but they're going to be called to the stand most likely because the defense just doesn't have another option. They are trying to keep, I think, Brian Koberger from receiving the death penalty if he is indeed convicted.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like that is the, I mean, obviously that's the ultimate goal, be to try and get him free, which doesn't seem to be like what they're shooting for anymore. It seems far more to just keep him in the cage. Former boxing coach Jesse Harris, character witness or a pattern disruptor. He's going to be called, or he is being called. Harris ran the gym where Koberger trained. He was subpoenaed and will potentially testify about Koberger's behavior and personality during his youth, specifically that time between him being the younger Koberger, where he was a bit overweight, being picked on. We've all heard that story. Then he seemed to get into boxing, lost a lot of the weight, and from what we heard, personality changed quite a bit. What do you think we're going to garner from the boxing coach if he does take the stand?
Well, you know, that was such an interesting part of his background that I think could sort of blow up on the defense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because he's going to paint Koberger as a very motivated individual, somebody who lost around 110 pounds, somebody who wanted to be in shape, who wanted to be respected in terms of his physical capabilities. And I think if he's truly called, honestly, I think this helps the prosecution because the prosecution is going to show how fit he was. And of course, a lot of people say, oh my gosh, he murdered four people in this small period of time. You'd have to be physically fit. Well, guess what? Brian Koberger was physically fit.
Yes. I was thinking the same thing. I thought, well, what is the advantage here going to be of this? And they got to play it really careful with anybody that they call back from his past, because, I mean, anybody from his past that we've heard publicly speak about him in the last 3 years, I've yet to hear one that's like, great guy. Super dude, always nice, always there, always. It's like everything's like kind of odd, kind of weird, had a temper, had a lot of anger issues, had a lot of, you know, issues with interacting with other human beings. I don't know what the advantage is here of the boxing coach, because he's going to do exactly what you just said. He got in shape. He got motivated to be in shape. And I mean, we're talking about boxing. It's kind of a violent sport. It is boxing. It's not like he got into track. It was his track coach or something. It shows, you know, it's an aggressive type thing. I'm concerned that that's going to, I mean, I'm not pro Koberger, but I would, if I were the defense, I'd be concerned that that would backfire. I would also be concerned about any questions about his personality and what this man may have witnessed in Koberger over those years, considering a lot of people said he changed quite dramatically personality wise at that time.
Right. It's a tightrope. I think it's a dangerous tightrope. I'm sure they're going to try to show, listen, he was picked on. He was bullied. And look at how he pulled himself up by his bootstraps and, you know, meant to do very good in this arena of letting his aggression out in a controlled environment, something like that. But I think it's very sticky. And, you know, remember that it's alleged that Kaylee Gonzalez was actually punched. So I think that's also going to be interesting because now you have somebody, a kickboxer, but somebody who's trained to fight. And that comes in. It's dangerous territory for the defense.
It's almost like they're trying to paint a story of redemption or something in his early youth. The guy who got his stuff together, who really, you know, saw, okay, I'm not gonna be the fat kid in the basement that's being made fun of. I'm gonna change my life. I'm gonna go and do this. But what ended up seeming to happen, I don't know, it was redemption, but more of like a psychological regression, because from everything we've heard, sounds like Koberger kind of wanted to, you know, square up all the loose angles of everybody who made fun of him in the earlier years. When he finally kind of got a little confidence and a little bit more in shape, it wasn't a, hey, let me join the group and let me, you know, be one of you guys now and let's have fun and enjoy life. It's more like, let me go settle all the scores from the past.
Yeah, I agree. This is a case that, in my view, I've always stated it. If he indeed do this, it's a state of retribution. It's a state of revenge. That was his mindset. And he built the tools to do that by calling some of the people from his past. We're going to see how really possibly this monster was created.
High school advisor Ann Farum, voluntary testimony and strategic optics are what's at play here. Farum has already agreed to testify. This is one who said, okay, I'll do it, avoiding a court battle. Her appearance may lend an image of credibility and care, someone stepping forward uncoerced. What do you think we're going to hear from the high school counselor? She would be one who would have known him pretty well at that point in time when a lot of these things were going on in his life and a lot of trouble was being talked about. And a lot of this is the area where he would have been talking about visual snow and such in the online postings that we've seen.
right? You know, Tony, this is the problem. This is how much what I would say the defense is really reaching. Mm-hmm. Going back to a high school counselor.
I know. I mean, the guy's 30 now.
Yeah. It's really, really a far reach to try to make this person your character witness. I mean, I would believe that they have interviewed her with their investigators and that perhaps she has said something that is sort of paints him in a light of, as you said, somebody who was just struggling, kind of the kid that just always picked on and trying to show some sort of sympathy or some light of sympathy for him. Again, I just don't think it's going to hit with the jurors because it's so long ago. And it doesn't matter when you consider the crime mm-hmm. that he did. You can't have the excuse of, well, I was picked on when I was in ninth grade. That's really not going to fly.
I can't imagine. I mean, just the idea of being 30 and whatever crime it is you committed, that your best witness is your high school counselor. It's who had not was like almost 10 years prior to the crime even taking place, even further now, that this is the best you got. This is really the only person that's going to be able to stand up for you and say he was a very nice boy. It's just what is that? Yeah, I mean, I guess it really is coming down to trying to see. Okay, maybe he wasn't always evil, or maybe there was a side to him that existed prior. I mean, I'm wondering if they're trying to paint the side of him prior to his transformation, if you will, the softer side, the lighter side, the side that got picked on, the side that may have been a little bit more compassionate. I don't know.
Yeah, I think they are. I think they're trying to show sort of that he wasn't always like this. And again, I see it as gaining sympathy or at least some sort of empathy for this person so that when it comes to sentencing time, they can spare him. That's what I see that the defense is trying to do.
The jail guard, he is going to be a witness. He was the guard post-arrest out there in Pennsylvania. He's a witness who is a corrections officer, supervised Koberger at that point in time. Defense may want to show that Koberger was calm, cooperative, and not displaying erratic behavior post-arrest. But was he, though? I mean, this is someone who, if we remember back at that point in time, and I'm curious to get your memory of what was going on at that point in time, one of the first things I think we heard about was his bizarre demands for ways of cooking his food in prison of don't use pans that have touched meat as if he's at the Four Seasons. I couldn't even imagine asking that at the Four Seasons, but he's asking it in jail. What do you think that's going to, just let's start with the jail. We'll talk about the cooking methods later, but the jail, the guard, what do you think the jail guard is going to bring to this in terms of helping or maybe even hurting Koberger?
Well, this is another tightrope. I mean, was one thing that he observed going to be positive for Koberger, such as you mentioned, that he was calm, that remember there were allegations, in fact, it's documented, that he said, was anyone else arrested? Mm-hmm. We know about that early on. Did he say further little tidbits like that this guard overheard or that he said straight to the guard? So I think they're going to want to just try to cloud up what might have happened, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is something that Bundy allegedly did, too, where they dangle out these possible carrots that somebody else was involved mm-hmm. When really it's just strategic and smart to say things like that because it can be distracting away from his own guilt. So I'll be interested to see, but I'll also think that this guard will also probably have information that might not be so positive just from my past knowing what guards see mm-hmm. and what they take note of. I mean, they get to see these guys 24/7 almost, at least when they're on shift mm-hmm. And they're supposed to be watching them and monitoring them. And imagine if 24/7 every single minute by somebody, it'll be interesting to see if there were mistakes made by Koberger that could be positive for
How often do we see guards called in cases like this? It's hard to say like this because there's not a lot that are like this. But how often do we see a guard like this called? And is it kind of like a desperate move that this is the person you're going to be calling as the defense? Or is this, I don't know, it seems like this is a weird one compared to witnesses to the crime, about the crime, the guard itself. Like what, how unorthodox is this or is it not?
Well, you know, when you look back, let's take a case that we both know well. It's the Delphi case.
Yeah.
You may recall that there were issues in terms of the guards actually overhearing the conversations with the defense attorney and Richard Allen.
Yeah.
And that really became a huge issue, what was recorded, what wasn't, what they might have heard, what could have been passed on. And, you know, that judge in that particular case kind of shut everything down. But in this case, you know, Judge Hippler is fine with, I think, allowing some of these some of the information in. And obviously we see that because he's on that witness list. I'm going to be interested to see, though, if he's actually called or if this, again, is just somebody on the list.
Yeah. So a lot of people that are on the list, some are, you know, contesting this, saying, you know, we do not want to go and have to testify. A lot of them are trying to compel them to testify. If they get the subpoenas and they contest the subpoenas, if forced to testify, unwilling witnesses, you know, they can be hostile sometimes, unhelpful on the stand, even if they're being brought in to try and stand up for this guy, especially if they think he's guilty. If they're like, yeah, I mean, I knew him in high school, but he was, you know, I don't know him now, and I could see him being the one who did this. This is kind of a big bet that it feels Ann Taylor is placing on these people to show up and provide anything that's really going to be of help.
Well, Tony, it's a slippery slope. And once you put somebody up on the stand like that, though, they can come off sometimes, as you mentioned, hostile. They can come off as not being truthful. We saw that recently in the Karen Reed trial, where certain witnesses were called that did not want to be there. And they made just a horrible impression of themselves because they didn't want to be there and they came off hostile. So, again, it's a slippery slope for Ann Taylor to be going after this. But I see it as her overall pattern of kind of, you know, putting up what might and might not work. This is a true throw the spaghetti on the refrigerator and see if it sticks situation. And that's why I think she has this tremendously long and unusual witness list.
Let's talk about the motions that have been denied. The third party culprit motion, Judge Hippler said, nope, we're not doing that. He denied it. And the sealed motion to present alternate suspects, citing lack of direct evidence and pure speculation. We went through that document the other day. And I guess I want to know what the hell do you think Ann Taylor was thinking with submitting that, other than let's see if this spaghetti sticks too? Because obviously none of the people on that list had anything to do with this, and nor would it ever make it into the courtroom, considering they've all been cleared by the FBI. And it, I mean, what do you think she was doing with that? Was that just to create some reasonable doubt in the potential jury pool that exists out there in the ether right now, so that when they do get that pool, maybe they'll remember, remember there was that alternate suspect list, but they don't understand fully what that matters or how that, what that means, and that it really didn't mean anything. What's your take on it?
Well, I think it's twofold. I think, first of all, what does she have to lose?
Yeah.
You know, trying to throw this out there, create these long motion documents that this judge has to go through, decipher, put the law to it. The prosecution has to answer, and that they can hope somehow, you know, is not denied. This was an easy one, though, for Judge Hippler, and specifically, you know, when she tried to cite the DNA, which the DNA wasn't even on scene. So it's just really, in a sense, I think, a bit mind-boggling to those of us who know this case inside and out that she would attempt this. But by the same token,
she has nothing to lose. So yeah. What else is she gonna do? She's got to throw something out there, kind of like the alibi of he was driving around in the middle of the night, which puts him exactly doing what the cell tower information says he was doing, which was driving around. To me, that was a win for the prosecution when she said that. I think the other thing, Tony, is we have seen the play, and even though a lot of it was redacted of this motion, how much social media can play into these cases. And certainly, I think she wants to get a lot of her contentions, all be them, far-fetched, out there in the social media venue, and certainly feed the pro-burgers, because yeah. There is a group that is definitely pro-release of Brian Koberger.
There is. And I do not understand one iota of it. they come to our YouTube channel and they don't really bring anything. They just like to say, he's innocent. Okay, and why is that? And then they like to say, you don't know anything. Okay, well, what do you have? You don't know anything. Okay, well, I do know some things, but what do you know? Why are you backing this up? You hate Brian Koberger. Okay, that's how the conversations go. I don't understand where any of them are coming from. I mean, you, I'm sure, have seen them out there. They're nowhere near the level of Karen Reed, FKR folks, but they're a little group that's budding. Like it's like they were born recently and they're toddlers right now and they're learning how to use their keyboards. Where are they coming from? Where do you glean anything off of these people as to where they're coming from, as to why they think Koberger is innocent, or they just want to join a club that nobody else is a part of yet?
Well, I saw the group starting to form actually very, very early on. It was just so few in number. But it's getting traction, I think, because some of the people from the other trials that are now over, they're kind of going over there and jumping on the bandwagon, right?
Yeah,
why is the interesting thought?
Yeah.
Why in the world? Everybody wants to see Brian Koberger's rights protected. There is no better advocate probably out there than Ann Taylor herself.
Mm-hmm.
She has delayed this trial. She has tried every avenue to try to get justice for her client, which she should be doing. So it's not like he's not well represented. It's not just her. He also has a slew of lawyers that have worked or are working on his case. There has been seemingly no limitation of budget. I mean, the amount of money being spent, the raises, the personnel. The court system has allowed, in other words, there's no expense spared from making sure Brian Koberger receives a fair trial. So, Tony, to your point, I think a lot of it is just noise, and people try to make a name for themselves. And that's what they're doing. That's how I see it.
Why do you think it is that they have such a budget for this trial? Granted, it's very, very high profile, but at the same point, it's another trial. It's another case. It's another murder case. Granted, it obviously involves many people. But maybe this is more of a legal question, but where do they determine the budgets for what case? Where, like, one gets, okay, you get your attorney from the state, good luck. He's getting everything, for free from the state. It's not like he has millions of dollars here to spend on these attorneys or any of the legal defense. The taxpayers are paying to defend Brian Koberger. Why this, carte blanche to the checkbook?
Tony, I brought this up before because I will say, in our system, it is so unfair. You can go to some states and the expert witness is going to get paid $50 an hour. I'm not kidding you.
Yeah.
Other states, it's $500, $600, $700, $800. It just depends on the judge and his allotment. So it's really insane, the budgets that are decided solely by the judges. And remember, a lot of this budget was decided well before Judge Hippler was involved. Mm-hmm. And so for that reason, I think the horse done left the barn, and a lot of those constraints just weren't made. So it was carte blanche. But in a way, to me, I'm happy from the standpoint of for this case not to be appealed, for his mm-hmm. Sixth Amendment rights to be protected, because this is a scary individual.
Yeah.
If for some reason he were exonerated, you know, it's the thought of him being let out. I just, you know, I'll mimic what my good friend Dr. Picotta said. It could be a very scary situation if he were acquitted.
Yeah, I can agree. Obviously, the third party theory is off the table now. The defense is going to have to pretty much attack the prosecution's case directly. Do you think they will? Do you think we're going to see a real solid attack of the prosecution's case, considering I don't know that they have a whole lot to do attack it with? Granted, we have these witnesses here that they're trying to compel to testify, but at the end of the day, you got a high school counselor, a boxing coach, and whoever else they can, you know, finagle to show up over there. I mean, is that a defense you even want to raise, or do you think this may be one where it kind of goes the way of Diddy or Daybell or anything, where when it comes time to them for them to present their witnesses, they may just go, we're done, we're good, we're just going to rest on everything we argued on cross?
Oh, they've got rabbits up their sleeve. First of all, they're going to discredit try to discredit all that cellular telephone information, and they have expert witness that they have acquired. Mm-hmm. And I think he will be, you know, do the best that he can to try to dissuade the jury that the prosecution's information regarding all the cellular data is accurate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think at the end of the day he'll be successful. He's been out of the business for a long time, certainly qualified and certainly an expert. But you're going to have the best of the best with the FBI's CART team on the stand, and I think they're going to be pretty unshakable. I think they're also going to go after the car data. Recall that in the probable cause affidavit, it was originally thought to be 2011 to 2013 mm-hmm. Vehicle, Hyundai Elantra. But, of course, Koberger has 2015, and so that expert, which was an FBI expert, had to go back and revisit why the configuration of the car he limited only to 2013 mm-hmm. and that he had to incorporate up to a 2015. So they're going to go after that. They're certainly going to really go hard after these witnesses. I mean, they're going to try to cut up Dylan Mortensen's testimony and try to show that she was drunk, that it wasn't really a big deal what she saw, that she was texting. They're going to really try to paint her in the worst light possible. We have the DoorDash individual who now, you know, has some an issue. It was from a year prior. Because you get a DUI a year prior, in my view, doesn't mean that you can't testify you saw somebody at a murder scene.
Sure.
Totally unrelated. There's no information she was drunk, drinking, under the influence during that instance in time. So the bottom line is I see them vigorously going after each of these witnesses.
And those are two big ones. Dylan Mortensen out there. Obviously, there are still people out there who are like, well, why didn't she call the police? And if you look at it, if you spend some time and don't just live in the ether of YouTube and go and understand where this all happened and how this all happened, it makes sense. You can, at least to a logical person, I think, you go, okay, this makes sense. Was it what I would have done at that age in time? No, probably not. But I didn't grow up at this point in life either, nor did I have social media and the ways that these kids communicate today either. So it's a very different ecosystem. And I think once you kind of understand that, it makes a bit more sense. But yeah, they're going to end up going after the roommates. At the end of the day, how strong is the testimony of the roommates saying that they saw the man with the bushy eyebrows? Obviously, it's one person that does put him there, but we have DNA, we have the sheath, we have the shopping list, we have so many other things too. How powerful do you think it will be to have Dylan testify? And it's going to be another tightrope when she does get to cross on the roommates, not to come across as too harsh or anywhere near mean towards someone who also is a victim of this, who went through such a trauma the night that Koberger allegedly went into that house.
Well, you know, Tony, the good thing is I think there's a lot of corroborative information now. We have the 911 call where specifically they say before the 911 operator interrupted that there was somebody here last night. Mm-hmm. I think they even say in dark clothing. We've gone over those transcripts, but and then the fear and panic, the voice. Oh, my gosh. So there's a lot to corroborate sort of how she was feeling and why she did what she did. You know, this was a party house and these were party girls. And so I don't think it was the first time she'll be able to testify to this, but that maybe somebody had had a little too much to drink and passed out on the ground. I think that is something that makes a lot of sense, depending on, you know, the circle you're in and the time frame you're in. But at the end of the day, it's going to come down to Dylan Mortensen. The prosecution needs to let her have her cathartic moment on the stand, because I can't imagine how this is all going to come together for her. There's going to be, she knows she's going to be on television. This is, like you said, the worst trauma almost anybody could suffer, realizing how close you were to likely being murdered and recounting all of this. I think if she comes off as emotional and that this is a cathartic moment for her to tell her truth, I think it will go a long way, because you better be careful, defense, if you go after this young girl, assuming she's well-spoken and has it together and is emotional during direct examination.
That DoorDash driver, obviously another thing, initials MM. We've now seen her talking to someone at the police station after that. She was pulled over. It was operating while intoxicated, but it was not alcohol. It was prescription medication that she was supposed to be taking. But my God, a woman who has gone through a lot. I mean, it's almost like this is one of the most unlucky people I think I've ever heard of, with the tragedy and the trauma that she's seen with her husband, boyfriend, I think it was husband, being shot in front of her recently before this. And now she so unluckily is the DoorDash driver in the Brian Koberger case. I get why she's a little effed up at times and why she seemed the way she did. I don't think it disqualifies her from testifying at all. I guess the big question that we have to ask right now is, did she tell the police in her initial interview that she saw Koberger and his car outside the house that night? Because I think a lot of jumping on this is that she didn't say that. But do we even know that? That could very likely still be sealed testimony that we just do not know the answer to yet. Is that, let's start with that. Is that correct? Do we just not know the answer to that question?
That's a fact. Okay. We haven't seen her FD-302, which is really actually Jenks material for that FBI agent who wrote it.
Yeah.
It's not a statement unless they write out a statement. It's not theirs. It's that officer's statement. Mm-hmm. So let's start with that. But if this was recorded, or if she actually, they had her hand write a statement, we haven't seen any of that. So for people to be prejudging what she did and didn't say, all I know is she absolutely said twice now, I've seen it once in the booking room and once in a vehicle, that she feels so bad, I think, because she doesn't want to be discredited, because she knows she's an important witness in the Brian Koberger case, the case against him. And, you know, I really feel for this woman from the standpoint of her understanding the gravity of what her information is. And that makes me think she did give that specificity early on. But again, did she say she saw bushy eyebrows? Did she just generally describe him? Does she say after she saw a photo, she knew that that was Brian Koberger? Was she able to identify him in a photo array? We just really don't know those details. And for online people to speculate that she's a terrible witness and never said something and now is going to say something, I think is just out, in outfield not correct to do.
Yeah, I mean, now that we, I think the understanding is that we just don't know. We do not know what she said. And I, what I've been doing in my mind is like kind of taking it both roads. Like, okay, so if she did say it, everything's good, because then that's on record. It's going to come out, and then it pretty much negates her issues where she was under the influence of something and in that video that we all saw. If she said this early on, it's there. It's on record. If she didn't say it early on and it's on record, that does pose a problem, though. If suddenly this is something she's just saying later, for whatever reason that may be, that could be a difficult thing in front of a jury if this is after the fact. Would it not be?
Well, a difficult thing. So, you know, could it be a difficult thing? Yes, to a degree. But again, it depends on if that police officer wrote a statement, mm-hmm. or if she gave a statement. So, Tony, let's go with she was interviewed by the FBI and the FBI wrote an FD-302 mm-hmm. to document what she said. And if in that FD-302, it doesn't specifically state that she said it was Brian Koberger, that's their statement. Mm-hmm. So she could say, I failed to mention it. I didn't realize until I saw pictures of him actually in the car later that that was him. That's how he looked in there. There could be a lot of different, things she could say. But I agree with you that the credibility in a juror's eyes may start to wane yeah. if her story changed.
But they would have had to have asked her, would they have not? Did you see anybody at that scene? Did you see anyone near, in a car, anywhere? I mean, I can't imagine that wouldn't have been a question that was posed to her at that moment in time.
No, I agree, Tony. It would have been posed to her, but you can imagine how early on this is. This sure. is the next morning. Yeah. So the gravity certainly was known that there were four deceased individuals, but nobody knew the name Brian Koberger.
No.
Nobody knew what he looked like when she was originally interviewed. Nobody knew anything. So really, they were looking to jumpstart their investigation as to what car she might have seen, really, from this DoorDash driver, mm-hmm. And Dylan and Bethany. Those were their kind of starting points. So could she have said something like, yeah, I saw a white car, maybe not even able to describe it in detail. Sure. Yeah, there was a guy in there, and I only saw one in there. So I could see her initial statements being really skeletal. And then later, when he was identified, perhaps being shown in a photo array, or trying to compare with her original description. I mean, if she looked over at the car and said she saw a girl in there, that could be a problem, right,
yeah.
Tony?
Yeah,
but if she gave a scant description that loosely follows or is Koberger-like, I think she could be a really good witness.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think she could. It's just all is going to depend on what was said. And I've heard other DoorDash drivers weigh in on this over the last, several years now. And it's funny, I hear a mix of their perceptions, because I think it is kind of a personal thing. You have some DoorDash drivers that are saying, look, when we go and deliver something, we are looking around our car. We're looking around the property we're going to, because we want to make sure we're safe. Cool. I know that's probably the way one should be if you're delivering DoorDash to random homes you don't know about. And I've heard others going, look, we just get out of the car real quick. We drop it off. We get out of there. We try to get another delivery. We're not paying attention to anything. So it's very much, I think, a probably a personal mindset of what one would be, or how one would be approaching the situation if you're a DoorDash driver.
Yeah, I agree. And one thing we also don't know, many DoorDash drivers, I say that right?
Yes.
They take a picture of the
food.
The food that they place.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that's going to be critical too. Did she take a photo?
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to give us a great timeline if indeed she says, okay, I dropped it, I turned around and a white car pulled up.
Yeah.
Or I dropped it and was leaving and I passed a white car. All of that, I mean, if she took a photo, and we don't know.
Yeah.
But they often do, Tony.
They do. I'm just wondering, was it standard practice at that time? Because we're talking 3 years ago, too. And I'm trying to wonder in my mind when that became standard practice. Because I want to say that was within the last 5 years.
Yeah. I mean, look, my son was a DoorDash driver in college mm-hmm. for yeah. large parts. So obviously I've talked to him about
sure.
this.
Yeah.
And I mean, he, you know, when you're a guy, it's, I think, a little bit of a different perspective. It sure. certainly depended on the time of day mm-hmm. and exactly the neighborhood you were dropping at. But I could tell you, he was snapping those photos, and that would have been, you know, back in about right around this time frame,
yeah.
2021,
22-ish. 22, yeah.
So, no, I know Idaho was 22, but he was doing it in 21, okay, sure. 22.
Well, if he was snapping in 21, then I guess they were snapping by that time. So, I mean, that will be an interesting point to this, to see what, wouldn't that be fascinating if the DoorDash shot of the food somehow catches something. Somehow the Jack in the Box is the thing that wins the day. We're obviously getting very close to the trial starting here. We're literally at this point now weeks away from the jury selection beginning. Obviously, the defense had wanted to stay. The judge denied that motion, saying we are going forward here. Jury selection starting August 4th. Obviously, in the interest of not having any sort of appellate issues, the judge seems to be pretty straightforward and confident that we're good on this. Do you think both sides have had enough time to prepare, and should they be going on August 4th?
Well, you know, the first go around, I said there is no way. Yep. And this go around, I've said, wow, very surprised. I was waiting for his actual written response mm-hmm. because he's been saying throughout these court, you know, proceedings that guys better be ready. Mm-hmm. You know, he's been intimating that we're going to go. And sure enough, he's going to go. I still remained a bit surprised. I thought there would be one more continuance. Not that I want one more mm-hmm. continuance. I love the backbone of this judge.
Yeah.
This judge saying, listen, this has been almost 3 years. Let's get justice for these kids. This has just gone on too long. You've had every delay that is imaginable, and we're going to move forward. But I really thought she would get one more just toward, you know, maybe the end of the year, you know, a few months delay. But we're starting now. It's actually kind of shortened, right? We have jury selection now on the 4th mm-hmm. of August, trial starting the 18th. But believe me, when you say the 4th, now it's ramped up ahead of schedule.
Yeah.
Right? You don't have it on the 11th. That's what I consider when I hear trial starting. It starts with Verdeer. And wow, we're starting early. They've got so much to do to prepare for that. You know, any good attorney and any FBI agent will tell you the trial is decided on when you choose that jury.
Sure.
That's the most important stage of any trial.
They're saying that this could go all the way into mid to late November, with starting in August. I'm curious about that. August, September, October, that's 4 months. Do you think we're going to see it go that long, considering the defense doesn't have a lot, honestly? I mean, obviously they got some stuff they're going to try and bring. Like you said, they have some things up their sleeves, but I don't know. It feels like that's a long chunk of time for, I don't know, I feel like the prosecution can get through their stuff in a, I don't know, handful of weeks. Is it going to go all the way to November? Or is this going to be a shorter one than you think?
I think it's going to be long, Tony. And, yeah. and a lot of that is based on Ann Taylor herself. Mm-hmm. I see her processes. I can only imagine how elongated these cross examinations are going to be. I see motions coming up in the middle of trial. I see a lot of things that are going to make this trial really, really long. I also think that the prosecution is going to want to put on everyone to prove their case. They're not going to want to hold any witnesses back. They mm-hmm. need to put on everything. And the defense is going to have some good defense rebuttal witnesses, I believe. So I think it will go long.
It's going to be fascinating. I think if I got to go back and look at the tape, but this would have been 3 years ago when I asked you, when do you think this is going to happen? And I believe you said 2025, like right after everything went down. And so I think you win the free $5 Applebee's gift card that we give away when you... Enjoy half an order of buffalo wings.
Well, thank you, Tony. Yep, this $5 gift card will get you. They can't even buy a greeting card anymore.
No. And
greeting cards are $10, Tony.
Next time it's Shoney's, so just don't get too excited. But it's going to be great.
Oh, that's great.
Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, as always, thank you so much for your insight on this case. As here we go, we're wrapping up. It's about to get started.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.